Got it.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Real Sports Talk Radio, courtesy of BackSportsPage.com, broadcasting live exclusively on BlogTalkRadio.com. You can get in contact with us here at the show at 760-283-0846 and follow us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/BackSportsPage, as well as on Twitter at BackSportsPage. Now here's your hosts, Jose Padilla and Randy Zell.
If Abraham Lincoln, who was born today, can figure out how to emancipate the slaves, we should be able to figure out how to take that darn
intro.
Well, I can't really. I don't like to cuss. I'm trying to get away from that. It's my Lent starts tomorrow, so I'm trying to give up cussing for life.
Ah. You're giving up caffeine and cursing.
For
what's left? You're not going to be. Yeah, I heard you for Lent. You're not going to be very interesting.
Well, who says I'm interesting to begin with? That's the better one.
Not too many people.
Exactly. So welcome to the show. It's been an interesting week, as it always is. We look forward to hearing from the Deloitte auditors. If you'd like to call in, 760-283-0846. We're still in the quest for the brunette, so if you'd like to make an appearance, please do so. And pitchers and catchers reporting this week, which, thank God, that means that baseball's around the corner, which also means that spring's around the corner, although you would not have known it over the last 72 hours in New York City.
It's February. It's the second week of February. Spring's around the corner?
Hey, the Groundhogs... The Groundhog said 6 more weeks.
The way it feels outside, are hoping it's going to be 6 more weeks.
Jeez, hey, we believe in the Groundhog. It's all about Punxsutawney Phil.
I guess if Bill Murray can get Andy McDowell on the 87th try, anything is possible. Welcome to the show, everybody.
That gives me some hope, I got to tell you. So you're saying there's a chance.
There's always a chance. An interesting week in sports, not a lot of major things, but a lot of minor. And I want to start off with something which came out today on ESPN and sports and CNNSI. It really disturbed me. I'm not a big fan of wrestling. I'm not a Greco-Roman fan. I watch it every 4 years. But it's one of the few sports that truly personifies the Olympics. And that they've decided to get rid of it. While bringing in sports over, tennis, golf is coming in soon, rugby's coming in soon. You can't get rid of wrestling in the Olympics. It doesn't make sense. One of the most important things, I actually saw this on Mike and Mike in the Morning, or heard it on Mike and Mike in the Morning, and I don't always agree with what they say, but I thought what Greenberg said was legitimate. An Olympic sport, the apex of an Olympic of a sport, should be winning a gold medal. For track and field, the apex, the best that you can get is winning a gold medal. Best that you can get in tennis is winning Wimbledon, not winning a gold medal. The biggest thing you can do in wrestling, which goes back to the ancient Greeks thousands of years ago, even before the modern Olympics, is winning a gold medal. How in the heck do you get rid of wrestling in the Olympics?
Well, I think it's even more to the point is that I'm reading these stats off of ESPN. Wrestling features 344 athletes competing in 11 medal events in freestyle and 7 in Greco-Roman at last year's Summer Olympics. Isn't the point of the Olympics to involve as many people as humanly possible? I don't know many other sports that involve 344 people.
No,
that's incredible. I mean, such people as Roddy White of the Atlantic Falcons tweeted his displeasure. He said, quote, IOC, come on. Seriously, wrestling is a sport that almost every country does, and you drop it. I'm pissed.
Yeah,
he's right.
He is right. They've gotten support, Lolo Jones, a lot of the Olympic athletes, because they understand, you know, when this is the biggest event, you know, I kind of stick to this idea, this ideology, that if the biggest event in this individual sport is the Olympics, it should not be eliminated. And
interesting thing was the two sports that were being considered are two of the oldest sports, one being wrestling, which was eliminated, and the other one was the modern pentathlon, which was been on the Olympic program since the 1912 Stockholm Games. So, I mean, they're going out with the old and in with the new. To tell you the truth, I don't view rugby as an Olympic sport. I just don't see it. And now wrestling will join seven other sports applying for inclusion in 2020. The others are baseball and softball, karate, squash, roller sports climbing, wakeboarding, and wushu, which I really don't even know what that is, and I will look that up. But the fact of the matter is, none of those, to me, say Olympics. They all say professional. Now, wushu is both an exhibition and full contact sport derived from the Chinese martial arts. So it's basically martial arts. It's like karate.
Wushu.
Wushu. W-U-S-H-U. Wushu.
Sounds like what I had for lunch yesterday.
That was mushu pork.
It was. Mushu. Let's call the whole thing off. Okay, that was terrible. Maybe I should give up. I should give up trying to be funny for Lent. Jesus,
that's not a chance. Anyway.
Well, what else do I bring? So, roller sports.
Roller sports is one of the sports that is up in 2020, along with now wrestling. Now, what I find interesting is that two of the bigger countries in Germany and Russia. Both have said that wrestling should not be eliminated, including Russian Federation Mikhail Mamishvili. And he said, including defending, quote, wrestling's place before the IOC. Now, the question to me is, who the hell is deciding this if these guys aren't? Isn't the point that your representative should be deciding what goes in the Olympics, not some abstract people? It kind of reminds me of the BCS. Let's put the guys that don't have a clue in charge of the sport and figure out who the best one is. Let's put the guys that don't have a clue in charge of the Olympics and see which sports really shouldn't count. So I'm with you. Rugby will be joining the program in 2016. The last sports removed were baseball and softball, voted out by the IOC in 2005. And the interesting thing is the U.S. stunk in baseball and dominated in softball. And that's the reason they got rid of softball to begin with, was because the U.S. was, I think they won like 64 straight games.
I think they ended up losing one, but I think they've won every gold medal, if I remember correctly.
So basically, they're Russians in hockey.
Well, Russian hockey many, many years ago. That's certainly long gone. Moving forward, so we've expressed our annoyance on that. And speaking of things, expressing my annoyance isn't the right way to put it. We do have NFL free agency coming up. The one big signing so far, Michael Vick, after saying he would not return to Philly, has come back on a restructured contract for 1 year, $10 million. Now, the thought is he could...
Whoa. It's not $10
million. I thought it was $10
million. Let's understand. He gets $3 million now, and if he doesn't win the starting job, they can cut him before day one. And he won't earn the other seven.
It's a potential of $10 million. I apologize. So
correct.
The idea is he didn't want to come back. You know, his loyalty with Andy Reid, who was fired, whatever you want to call it, by Jeffrey Lurie. The team has no offensive line and played about as unmotivated a football season as anyone I can remember. Last year, going 4-12 with a team that certain people picked to go to the Super Bowl. And the offensive line isn't any better. The running, I mean, there's still a lot of talent there. I guess he feels a loyalty to Jeffrey Lurie after Lurie bringing him back after his time in Leavenworth. But I'm genuinely surprised that he's back in Philadelphia for next year.
Who else is going to pay him $10 million? Even the potential for $10 million. Who else is going to pay him that?
That is true.
I mean, let's look at the teams that need quarterbacks. You got the Cardinals who are paying Kevin Cobb $21 million next year, which will be restructured. We all know that, but that's where that is. They got Cleveland, and he wasn't going to Cleveland. You have the Jets. Trust me, the Jets were not entertaining that. They have, I mean, where else was he? Kansas City? I mean, there weren't many places where Michael Vick could go, and even more so, there were no places where he was going to get paid $10 million, the potential for $10 million.
That is true.
I'm not really surprised at all.
That is true, but it also surprises me, considering I'm surprised Lurie made that offer. It's probably a better way to put it. You knew they were going to restructure the deal under all capacity. They were going to restructure the deal. But, you know, the potential for a double-digit salary, considering the year he's come off of, where he was debatably and is debatably going forward the worst quarterback in the NFC East, I'm a bit shocked. I'm not going to lie to you.
Well, we hope not.
No. Fair. Thank you for clearing that up for me. The other good news is Joe Flacco's agent is now going to be meeting next week with Ozzie Newsome and Eric DaCosta. Or I guess in Steve Biscotti, to try and negotiate a long-term contract. I don't believe it's going to happen. You know, you said this for the last 6 weeks to 2 months, and I agreed. And, you know, him winning the Super Bowl MVP, while absolutely warranted, doesn't really change the fact. This is a team not in great salary cap position. They're going to probably lose, you know, the best safety most of us have ever seen in Ed Reed. Paul Kruger is a free agent. The linebacker, I forget the name off the top of my head, that really stood out this year, is going to probably replace Ray Lewis in the middle, I believe, is a free agent. Anquan Boldin is now saying if he's not re-signed, he doesn't have a chance to re-sign with Baltimore, he's going to retire. This is a team with a lot of salary cap flux. And, you know, Flacco, despite, you know, what people are saying and what people – you know, Flacco is still not a top five. He's never put together a great regular season. He's had a great last two playoff years. But there hasn't been the consistency that I would want to give somebody, you know, what he wants over a 5-6 year deal.
Well, the guy that you're thinking about is Daniel Ellaby. And
okay.
He's the inside linebacker. Now, there are a couple of big questions going on in Baltimore. And I think number one is, do they keep Terrell Suggs at $11.5 million? I think that's a bigger question than Flacco. Because if you cut Terrell Suggs, you can basically replace him with Paul Kruger. So the question is $11.5 million worth keeping Terrell Suggs coming off last year he had a torn Achilles? This year he now has a torn triceps and may have to have surgery on that. So with all that's going on in Baltimore, is it worth it to them to keep these guys? I mean, Ozzie Newsome has said it best. The last time they went to the Super Bowl, they brought the gang back, and they suffered tremendously. Well, now the question is, they said that they won't do that again, and they'll make cuts based on that. Is Terrell Suggs one of those cuts? And out there lurking is the Cleveland Browns with $43 million worth of cap room available and a whole lot of free agents in the AFC North. So if they craft a deal where the first year of the contract for Joe Flacco is $20 to $25 to $30 million, and they're willing to give up two first-round picks for that, I think the Browns have the sixth pick this year, is it worth it to them to do that to get a quarterback and not only to get a quarterback, but also to damage their division rival.
It almost feels like the Jeremy Lin poison pill.
It's absolutely that way. Absolutely. And I think that you're going to see Cleveland go after Joe Flacco. I think you're going to see them go after Mike Wallace, who's also a free agent. I mean, they're thinking at this point, or they could be thinking, is how do I get better and damage my opposition at the same time? Well, each of these teams in their division, which is Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, and Baltimore, all have free agents. And you know what? With $43 million in the cap and a new owner, Jimmy Haslam, and a new president in Joe Banner, who last time we saw him was in Philadelphia, they can come armed ready to deal. I think you're going to see a lot of that going on in Cleveland. And I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if you see both Flacco and Wallace wind up in Cleveland.
That would be interesting. But then again, Kevin Youkilis is on the Yankees, so I guess anything. I guess rivalries don't really mean as much as they used to.
And supposedly Jabba texted him and said, all is good.
What did you say?
I said supposedly Jabba texted him and said, all is good.
Jabba who?
Exactly. Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah. I guess we should probably segue. That's kind of a nice little segue into baseball. Well, pitchers and catchers are here. I know that excites one of us.
Take me out to the ball game. Take
can you give us singing for,
the crowd.
Can you give for Lent also? Would that
What's
be
that?
Possible? Can you give up singing for Lent also?
Buy me some peanuts and crackers.
Okay. So
I'm much better at karaoke. For those that didn't attend Miss Fink's birthday party, and happy birthday to Miss Fink, you would have seen some very nice karaoke performed.
Well, unfortunately, one of us was snowed in beautiful, beautiful Wayne, New Jersey, trying to fulfill his working obligations. But I think we gave enough props to Jess last week to last her forever. Baseball is here, and yes, actually, Sean is a pretty badass karaokeer, especially when he's singing it when it's an angry song, a little bit of
an angry song. Yes,
can't imagine where that comes.
Rendition. It will be on YouTube at some point this year.
Oh, good Lord! So obviously, I have not given up cursing for Lent. So what are your biggest, you know, going into now it's February 15th, you know, February 10th, whatever it is. It's incredibly early. I mean, it's insanely early even for pitchers and catchers. What excites you going into spring training?
Well, what excites me is the fact that it's February 12th, which means that it's Lincoln's birthday. That's number one. And number two, what excites me is to see what kind of team the Astros are going to put together this year. Because they have traded away every single player of monetary value that they could possibly hope for. A couple of weeks ago, they traded away their starting shortstop. They traded away their starting pitching, their relief pitching, their outfit. I don't think they have a player that's earning more than $3 million, which is about what Alex Rodriguez earns in about 2 weeks. On their entire team. So the question is, will the Astros challenge the 1962 Mets with 120 losses?
Now let me ask you, as a Mets fan, would you prefer to give up that record? Or would you
Hell
prefer
no,
to keep
bring it?
It
on. I want that record. That record is a dubious record. We are the Amazons. And we should forever have that record. It will. That team was as bad as the New York Mets outfield will be this year.
Hey-o! First of 10,000 Mets insults to come about on Seth and Sean over the next 8 months. Wait, who is it? Except for Lucas Dada, who the heck is in the Mets outfield?
Kirk Nieuweis and Mike Baxter.
The Mike Baxter?
The guy that ran... the guy that saved Johan Santana's no-hit last year by dislocating his shoulder, on the wall. So yeah. So I mean, the Mets are just, I don't even know where to go with it. I mean, they were trying to get Michael Bourne, who somehow signed this yesterday with the Cleveland Indians. And that what amazes me is, and one of our listeners and close friend, Fred Steinem, Steinem had been talking to me about this all day, yesterday and today, about Michael Bourne and how Scott Boras is a magician. He always seems to get caught without being able to give the contracts they promised, and somehow he's able to finagle those contracts out of his tuchus.
His
tuchus. Well, tuchus is not a curse, my friend. Tuchus is yitch.
I'm aware. It's just very rare that a man who's giving up so much for Lynn talks about tuchus. So anyway, continue.
So it's amazing that Scott Boras had a free agent named Rafael Soriano who is opted out of a 1-year contract with the Yankees for $13.3 million. And everybody thought he would sign with the Tigers for big money. He languished out there, and all of a sudden now he's got a 4-year deal with the Nationals. Here comes Michael Bourne, who should have gotten a 5-year, $75 million contract from the Braves, except they signed DJ Upton to go with the brother Upton, Justin. And somehow yesterday, when everybody thought, oh, he'll have to take a 1- or 2-year deal, he signed a 4-year deal with the Indians, which could be a 5-year deal, for $48 to $60 million. Scott Boras is a magician, Michael. I only wish to learn from the master, or from what the GMs call him, the devil.
Well, Cleveland is such a strange. Do they still have Sinjin Shu?
No, he got traded to. He got traded to Cincinnati for Drew Stubbs, and Trevor Bauer.
Okay. So. So if I understand, in the last 12 months, Cleveland has signed straight up on Humaldo Jimenez, who I believe had signed a huge contract previously. They signed Nick Swisher for $50 million, 48, I think, over 4, same as Michael Bourne. Is this going to make this team any good?
Well,
I don't look at a Cleveland team. You know, I look at that division. Detroit's obviously the front runner. Kansas City, for the 18th time, is rebuilding with supposedly some real superstars in their youth, in their minor league system, enough that they would trade Will Myers to get a legitimate number 2 starter in James Shields. Chicago was pretty solid last year. Minnesota's a mess. Is this this team anywhere better than 3rd in the AL Central?
Well, I think the question is, going back to the movie Major League, are the groundskeepers still correct? They're still, since I can't cuss on due to Lent. But the question is, are they any better than mediocre? I think is, are they average? Are they able to put up a good fight for that wild card? I think they'll be okay. I don't see them as anything special. Their pitching staff is definitely not special. They now signed Mark Reynolds, too, so he's going to be their DH. Swisher's going to play first base. Their outfield actually is probably the best defensive outfield in the major leagues. It's Michael Bourne in center, Drew Stubbs in right, and Mike Brantley in left. And defensively, that's the fastest infield in the majors. But if you go around the infield's kind of horrible. I mean, so aside from Carlos Santana, who you have to love the name just in general, behind the plate, their pitching staff is atrocious. Their relief is kind of decimated. So, I mean, you're right. Do they have a shot in that division? Yeah, that division is probably the worst division in baseball. So, I mean, they have a shot. They have to hope for a lot of things to happen, such as Detroit to come back down, for Bruce Roden, who's the rookie closer for Detroit, to implode, for Prince fielded her to eat his way out of Comerica Park. Miguel Cabrera to get hurt or too fat to play third base. Victor Martinez to tear another ACL. Justin Verlander to have Tommy John surgery. I mean, yeah, they have to hope for all this to happen. It could happen. I mean, stranger things have happened. The Mets won in 2000, the Mets went to the World Series with an outfield of Jay Payton, Benny Agbayani, and Darryl Hamilton. So, I mean, stranger things have happened. But you're right. I don't think that it makes them any better than mediocre.
Well, the other big baseball news is Felix Hernandez re-signing with, or not re-signing, but agreeing to a 7-year, $170 million deal, give or take, with Seattle. Are you surprised, for as much trade talk as we've heard about Felix Hernandez over the last 2 years, are you surprised that Seattle would give him 7 years, would give him this contract?
I'm surprised when they gave it to him. Felix Hernandez has never wanted to leave Seattle. And Seattle has never wanted to trade Felix Hernandez, despite all the clamoring from Yankee and Red Sox fans that, oh, we're going to get Felix. Oh, we're going to. You guys were never close. He wasn't going anywhere. He has two more years left on his current contract, which they ripped up. So they gave him a 7-year deal. He's 27 years old. So by the time he's done with this, he'll be 34. And he's only 27. I mean, it seems like Felix Hernandez has been around for two decades. He's been around for 8 years. He started at 19. That's a lot of mileage on that arm. My problem with this is you had two more years to evaluate him and see if he would come down with an elbow injury or something like that. And you rip off those 2 years and give him 5 years on top of that and give him an increase in salary. So basically, if you're the Mariners, you haven't gotten a discount, although you've given the guy security. You've invested a whole lot in a pitcher, and we've seen pitchers do not generally hold up well over the course of big contracts. I mean, we can name them. I think the only pitcher that's relatively held up well over a big contract in the last 10 years, and listeners, correct me if I'm wrong, 760-283-0846, is CC Sabathia. I don't remember another pitcher that's gone through a big long-term deal that hasn't gotten injured or just stunk.
Come on, how
so
bad was
Felix Hernandez? One of those guys that can be like CC Sabathia. He certainly has the build. I mean, he certainly has the girth and he's got the arm and he has the body for it. But if you told me when the Mets signed Johan Santana that they'd only get 3 years out of a 6-year deal with him, I would say don't sign him. And that's all they got. So, I mean, I'm not surprised by the length of the contract. I'm not surprised that they actually did the contract or the amount of money. And granted, he's earning $25 million over the next 7 years. Like, that to me is unbelievable. For those that don't understand how that relates, that is the highest, that is the most amount of money ever committed to a pitcher at one time, $175 million. It's also the highest annual salary of any pitcher ever, $27 million per year, $27.5. The only player that has earned more than $27.5 million in any 1 year is the guy that was caught with steroids and continually denied Zerium, and that's A-Rod. And look how that contract turned out. So I'm not really surprised by the contract. I'm surprised by when it took place. He had two more years to evaluate. He wasn't going anywhere anyway.
Well, about halfway through the show, and I think we should kind of talk, hit on a sport we really haven't talked about very much this year. And it's been pretty good. And I'm talking college basketball. And I have been college basketball was my sport growing up. It's as I've gotten older, it's been tougher and tougher to follow simply because everyone leaves so quickly, and now ESPN televises it 8 days a week. But it's been an interesting year. You have no great team. You have a lot of parity. You know, you've had some really great games over the last week, actually, too. For instance, the Ohio State-Michigan game, which went overtime, really high quality. Michigan winning on a dispute. Well, Michigan winning in overtime by a deuce. And Notre Dame-Louisville, which only went five overtimes on Saturday night. Who do you think is the best team in the country? Because I'm not really sure.
Well, I think you nailed it right on the head. I don't think there is a best team in the country. I mean, you could say Indiana. I mean, I could give you probably the top eight teams in the country and say one of these is going to win it. But that doesn't really give you any solace at this point. I mean, you have Indiana, you have Duke. And right now the team that's playing the best is Miami of Florida. I mean, they have kicked the crap out of some of these teams, including Duke. 29 points. So, I mean, really, any one of these teams, Syracuse is six. I don't consider Syracuse a contender for the NCAA championship right now. I don't think they've been playing well enough to do that. But at the same time, you know what? They're sixth in the nation for a reason. They're 20-3. Gonzaga is 23-2. They're fifth. Michigan fourth at 21-3. Miami got 17 first place votes, 19-3, with Leonard Hamilton doing a fantastic. No, Leonard Hamilton's at Florida State. That's
Florida
State.
Jim Larranaga, Mason.
Yeah, Jim Larranaga, who last time we saw him was at George Mason. Duke at 21-2, and Indiana at 21-3. So, I mean, do I think any of these teams is a UNLV from the 1990s? No, absolutely not. None of these guys are going to roll through it. But I think one of those top six will probably take it home. And I think as a sleeper, I'm looking very hard at Michigan State lurking there at 20-4. The Big Ten is just stacked.
Well, that's why I found it so funny as a Maryland alum. When, you know, people were saying, well, you know, you're going to have to get better in football, but the basketball's taking it, can take, you know, they'll dominate in the Big Ten. I found it the complete, and I think I said this, I found it the complete opposite. I think Big Ten football is vastly overrated. I wouldn't put the Big Ten over the SEC, over the Pac-10, or over the Big 12. I believe the Big Ten is the best basketball in the country, and has been for the last several years. The ACC has had Duke, North Carolina, and nothing else. Although this year, as we said, you know, Florida State was good last year. Miami's been a revelation this year. But the ACC has not been strong in college basketball for the last 4 or 5 years. What happens is you have the same analyst saying the same thing every time, and everyone always believes it. If you watch it on a constant basis, you know this. The Big Ten has had Ohio State, Final Four team. Michigan State, Final Four team. Indiana, who's preseason number one. Wisconsin, who always wins the conference. Michigan has come back under John Boeheim, really, to be a top caliber school. You know, Minnesota's been okay, although they've kind of fallen back. I think the Big Ten has been consistently the best conference in college basketball the last few years. They just haven't won the titles to prove it.
Is it a fact? Well, I think there are two factors that go into this. First of all, when you and I were younger, say in high school and in the first part of our collegiate career, the Big Ten struggled in basketball. And I think that they got a reputation, especially teams like Purdue, of being soft, especially when they come down to the NCAA tournament. So I think it comes down to reputation more than anything else, and that's what you were saying with the ACC, is that the ACC has always had a reputation of being excellent in basketball, whether or not they've backed it up in the last couple of years. I think that's number one. Number two, you look at the coaches in the Big Ten, the coaches are phenomenal. I think more than any other sport, NCAA basketball is dictated by how the coaches are, and because that's how you get recruits. And the coaches in the Big Ten are better than any other coaches in any other league, to me.
Well, if you're going by getting recruits, then I would think the SEC would be right up there. Because, I mean, John Calipari gets everybody. And if anyone's watching, got Florida-Kentucky going on in a rivalry week, on the ESPN. you know, far, if Kentucky's not getting it, Billy Donovan's Florida team has been in the running every year. You know, get out. There have been some other decent teams. Ole Mississippi's having a very good year. But, you know, I guess from top to bottom, I would probably, you know, the SEC, I never find particularly strong in the middle or in the bottom, but at the top, it's always very strong. And their coach, those two coaches, Anthony Grant, also from Alabama, Kevin Stallings at Vandy, have been very good over the years as well. But, yeah, from top to bottom, the Big Ten, unquestionably, the coaches. You mentioned Thad Mott. And the toughness, I think, came when Tom Izzo came in the late, I guess, the late 90s, because he won the title in 99, in 2000. He'd been there for a few years prior to that. But you look at the coaches, Beilein, tough coach. Tom Crean, tough coach. You know, kind of that tough Midwest personality. And that's the way these teams play. And, you know, there are teams, you know, Aaron Kraft at Ohio State, you know, the tough defensive point guard from OSU. The Big Ten is really good. The ACC is not. You know, the Pac-10 is not, although Arizona's kind of had a little bit of a revival this year. You know, it's the problem is, and this has been the commentary that I keep saying, is by when you have all these players leaving after their freshman year, the caliber of college basketball has just not been very good over the last few years. And you could see that even with the UConn winning the national title 2 years ago. Now, they went on a great run, obviously, with Kemba Walker. That was not a championship-caliber team. That wasn't even close to a championship-caliber team 5, 7, 8 years ago. You know, I mean, the team I look at this year, probably the best team in the country to me is Florida. They're not, you know, they've had their ups and downs. They got annihilated at Arkansas. I do like, you know, Boynton, Patrick Young, Mike Rosario coming off the bench. I think talent-wise, I really like their team. Whether they can put it together for a tournament run, I don't know. And as you said, you know, the Michigan State, if there's one thing you can pick every year, it's Michigan State to go to the Sweet 16. That's just an automatic. To me, Izzo is one of the two or three best coaches in college hoops. And we'll, you know, and they don't get overwhelming talent, but that team just goes and goes and goes.
Ladies and gentlemen, Seth Kalin's basketball expert has returned to the Seth and Sean Sports Radio Show.
Well, I don't know how much of an expert I am anymore, but it's still at its best, it's still the most enjoyable sport to me to watch. I guess we're really kind of hitting all the sports today. I actually have a rant that I want to read. I received from Carly from New York. I'm going to bring it up now. And Carly's a New Jersey girl who was a Nets fan, and apparently there were a few. And she actually asked me to talk about this and on the show, and I'm always happy to oblige a friend.
So,
she was at the Laker-Nets abomination last week. And here we go. Oh, maybe not. I'm trying to find it. Pretty much the gist of it, she was mad. Okay, here we go. How at the Barclays Center did Kobe Bryant have an insane amount of cheering? Are Brooklyn fans not loyal to the Nets? I mean, the last time the Nets went to the finals, it was against the Lakers, and we got killed. There should be no cheering for Kobe. Okay, that's my rant. I made a couple comments back to it, but we'll just kind of go into the NBA.
Hold on.
Okay, I just had to mute Sean for that because I don't know why the hell he was playing Barbie Girl. And
No. That was Jersey Girl.
Oh, I thought that wasn't Jersey Girl. Jersey Girl is by...
I'm a Jersey girl in a Jersey world.
Is that like a Weird Al parody?
Yes.
Oh.
That's exactly what it was. It was a parody.
Well, I could barely hear it at that, and I'm sure our thousands and hundreds and thousands of listeners couldn't really tell. Now, Carly's an old-school Nets fan. But the thing is, Brooklyn fans aren't loyal to the Nets because the Nets have been in Brooklyn for 5 months. You know, they're happy that they're there, but loyalty is not something built in a week or a month or a year. You know, it comes over a long period of time.
But have the Nets done what they needed to do this year? I mean, let's assume that they set Deron Williams has been, I don't know if you can call him a disappointment or a disaster. Joe Johnson is what Joe Johnson always will be, which is overpriced. Brooke Lopez has done a fantastic job becoming probably the top center in the East. So the question is, have they done what they needed to do? I think they have. With all those problems, they're still fifth in the NBA in the East right now. They'd be in the playoffs, which is a far cry from where they were last year. And they've made the New York rivalry relevant.
Yep, I agree. They're not a team. You know, we had talked about this in our NBA special, NBA preview, that we saw this was a team more built for the regular season than the playoffs. But they've done exactly what they needed to do. They've become relevant. Now, that was the most important thing.
But we also said that thinking that Brooke Lopez wasn't going to be the way Brooke Lopez has played.
Yeah, I didn't say it came about exactly how we anticipated it. But the team is relevant. The team is good. It's a good team. It's not a great team. They may get past the first round of the playoffs. They may not. But there's something, there's a team that can build. They're not going to bring in more players, although apparently Josh Smith is now on their radar. Deron Williams has to be better. Simply put, if this team is going to progress to an Eastern Conference final, and which they won't this year, simply put, their best player has to play like their best player. And he hasn't. He wasn't happy with Avery Johnson. Well, Avery Johnson was fired. They bring in PJ, they go on a good run, and now they're kind of falling back a little bit. But overall, the most important thing with the Russian owner and Billy King, putting so much money, well, not Billy King, but the Russian owner putting in so much money toward this team, the most important thing was making them relevant on the national stage, and they've done that. So I think no matter what happens, assuming they win 50 games or in that range, I think this is a successful year.
Absolutely. Talk about an unsuccessful year. Let's go to the other coast and talk about, our favorite player, Dwight Howard, along with Kobe Bryant. So basically four Hall of Famers or Hall of Famers-to-be. And if you're the Lakers, what do you do? I mean, do you trade Dwight Howard before the deadline? I mean, right now, if I have to pick between the Lakers and the Nets, I think the Nets have a better future than the Lakers do.
Well, I don't think there's a doubt about that, because the Lakers, you have Kobe Bryant, who, while playing at an extraordinary level, is an old 35. And this is coming from someone, of course, who's a really, really old 36. Steve Nash is an old 39. Or I shouldn't say he's an old 39, but he's 37, 38. Gasol is just disgusted. Howard doesn't look like he wants to be there. And Howard is not built for that stage. The Los Angeles, New York market is just not meant for him. Even Nash was given, and Steve Nash has been considered the consummate teammate over the last decade. And I read an article in the Orange County Register today where Steve Nash was even making comments about this is how unacceptable Howard's behavior has been. Not stating it that specifically, but kind of that was it could be inferred. The Nets, Deron Williams is not old. Deron Williams is probably 28, 29, maybe 30. Joe Johnson's probably at the end of his prime, but Brooke Lopez is 25, 26. In their bench, they have some young talent in addition to the older talent. The Lakers have no youth except Earl Clark, and I'm not building a title team around Earl Clark.
Who's been on three teams since he made it, four teams since he's been in the NBA. Yeah, I totally agree with you. If you watched any of the Lakers versus, I think it was the Nets, Lakers-Nets on Sunday, you saw Dwight Howard basically getting yelled at by Steve Nash on the court. So, I mean, he was like, why are you doing what you're doing? You're not even rolling to the basket on the pick and roll with the best pick and roll player of our generation. But I think
number two. I still think that point guard in Utah.
Okay, fair enough. I think the interesting thing that I see is that Steve Nash is old, and he's ridiculously old. I mean, he looks if you're on the opposing team, you want to go at Steve Nash now. While you never used to do that. You want him bringing up the ball. I mean, it just seems like players are challenging Steve Nash like they never have before, and they relish the opportunity to play against him. Steve Nash wasn't a great defender ever, but now he's just very slow afoot. And the question is, has he gotten to the point where they're like point guards and centers, and I'm taking this from, I think it was Bill Simmons said this on the NBA pregame show on ESPN. Centers and point guards just lose it. They don't gradually lose. They kind of just crash and burn. It's just the end of their life, the end of their NBA life. Is this the end of Steve Nash? And Steve Nash has two more years on that contract.
Yeah. It's a really tough situation, and you know, someone made a comment, and it kind of cracked me up. But there's a bit of a hint of legitimacy. Is Jim Buss become the Dan Snyder of the NBA?
I don't know. When you look back to Gary Payton and Karl Malone, you see the same thing, don't you?
Well, I'm not talking. Are you talking about Nash? Or I was talking about how
Jerry Buss becoming the Dan Snyder. So I assume that means accumulating all the old stars.
Right, but that was Jerry Buss accumulated the old stars. Gary Payton and Karl Malone came in, I think, before Jim really came into power. Jerry was.
Oh, I was just talking about the Busses in general. I wasn't talking Jim or Jerry. I just said everybody. I mean, that's just the way I see it. It has made the concept of it's not just bringing in stars together, but it's bringing in the right stars together. And I know, Seth, you lamented the fact that LeBron went to Miami to be with his pals, Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade, and the fact that he cannot be the greatest ever because he did that, and we have our own disagreement around that. But you got to give LeBron a little bit of credit in the fact that he went to a place where he knew it, he didn't know, but he thought it was going to work, and it did, as opposed to Steve Nash or Dwight Howard saying, I'm going to go to this place, and it not working at all.
No argument.
And I think that's the question going on in Brooklyn is, can this work? And if we bring in a Josh Smith, and the reported trade is Chris Humphries and Marshawn Brooks along with the number one, I don't know how many more number ones they have. I mean, they gave up like three or four number ones already for Josh Smith. Athletically, that is a fantastic team. I mean, that's Brook Lopez, Josh Smith, Reggie Evans, Joe Johnson, and Deron Williams. But there is no bench going on after that. I mean, that is your team. Your bench is Gerald Wallace.
And the Serbian, I forget, Televocic?
Andre Blotch and Tyshawn Taylor. I don't know what Serbian you're talking about.
Miro, Mirko,
I'll look up the guy's name.
Oh, that guy, yeah. I don't know why he's not on the Nets roster. I'm looking at the Nets roster right now. He's not on it. Maybe he's injured right now.
Well, Taylor led them to a win in Indiana last night. Andre Blatch has been fantastic for them this year. So, you know, that may not be the worst situation. You know, the problem is, I mean, if you can sign Josh Smith to a long-term deal, you know, that is a starting, you know, that is an imposing starting five. And
agreed. And that's what they'd be looking to do, because the Russian premier that owns the Nets obviously is the new Mark Cuban and obviously does not care about the luxury tax one iota.
Nope. I guess when you're worth several billion dollars, and it just doesn't matter.
Yeah. So you're saying there's a chance?
No. Not even remotely.
Not even remotely. But at the same point, the NBA trading deadline is next. First of all, the All-Star game is this week. The trading deadline is next week. So hopefully we'll talk a little bit more about the trading deadline next week as it comes forward. Going on to other things, college football, not much going on there, but hockey has returned, and the LA Kings seem to be in a funk where they haven't sobered up from their hangover from the Stanley Cup playoffs. And I know my esteemed colleague is not the greatest of hockey fans, hockey aficionados, if you will, but I think he does have some insight onto some of the players. The Red Wings have looked incredible behind Zetterberg and Datsyuk. And the NHL seems just to be a better product having in a shorter season than they were drawn out. And I know you think that every single season – except for football, is too long. So what do you think about this shortened season?
You're right. I haven't, you know, I am not the most detailed hockey fan. I do know the Kings have been, you know, the Kings have struggled. The Islanders are the Islanders.
Hey.
had to get the little dig in.
There's a
yeah,
big dog.
I always, you know, I'm a big proponent of, you know, it's very difficult for me to care about a regular season, you know, a regular season NBA game when there's 82 of them. It just is. I don't care. You know, hockey is the same way. When there's 45 to 50 games, it's a lot easier for me to follow. A lot easier for me to know what's going on, and the games mean more. You know, you have a perfect example. You know, hockey, as you said, Chicago has been sensational. Nashville, I think, has been very good. The Kings have, you know, kind of come off to it. I've had some issues so far this year. And the Devils seem to be missing Zach Parise, well, not as much as you would have anticipated, you know, leading the East. But it's done well. You know, at the end of the day, you know, the fans just keep coming back. And until they don't, you know, it's not the most profound comment in the world, but until they don't, you know, it won't matter. You know,
I think that's the same with any labor dispute, and I think you're absolutely spot on there. I mean, until the fans say enough of this, the owners and the players pretty much have them at their whim. And that's what we've seen in the NHL this year, is the fact that, look, the casual fan, I don't know how many games you've watched, but I seem to watch – when the Islanders are on and I have – and I'm in front of my TV, which is often – I'm watching the game. I mean, I may not watch the whole game, but I'm certainly watching some of it. I've gone to more Islander games this year than I did already than last year in one month. So, I mean, I just think that the casual fan may be lost, but the hardcore fan is probably always going to be there.
Yeah, well, I think that's true in any sport. So
yeah.
We got about five to go. You want to quote? You want to close or start the close, or should I?
No, I'll start the close. I think that so this week we heard from the Paternos. We didn't touch upon this in the show, and quite frankly, I think 2.5 minutes is just enough to touch upon it. Look, in every argument, there are two sides. There's the A side and the B side, and somewhere in the middle is the truth. And that's what this is all about. When you get a report that says the exoneration of Joe Paterno You know it's a biased report. There's no way in anybody's mind that this, that the Turner report was not fashioned to be an exoneration of Joe. Look, do I think that he had did the paternal report bring up some inconsistencies in the Free report? Yes. No question about it. I've read both. And trust me, they're long reads. I don't wish that upon anybody. It's about 270 pages for the paternal report. And some things are not, I don't know. I mean, you just shouldn't read it. Take my advice. Just don't read it. But the fact of the matter is, was Joe Paterno vilified? Yes. Was he correctly vilified? I don't know. If he stood by and watched any of that or let any of that happen, yes, correctly vilified. But at the same time, was the Free report 100% accurate? No. So do you take either report as the standard? This absolutely happened? No. You take each one as evidence of that something happened. And you draw your own conclusions. I think, if nothing else, these two reports identified that there was a problem at Penn State. It hopefully has been rectified, and we can move on from there. Will you see the Joe Paterno statue returning to Beaver Stadium because of this report? Absolutely not. No, no. Look, the atrocity went on. And hopefully this closes the book. May you rest in peace, Joe Paterno.
Well, to answer your question, I have absolutely no interest in reading the reports. So I'm going to go. I want to wish someone a happy birthday. It's not you. Probably the most important athlete of our lifetime. In a way that, man, makes you feel old. Michael Jordan is 50 years old. On Sunday. No athlete grew a sport like Michael Jordan. No athlete grew an advertising mecca like Michael Jordan. He started it all. You know, Nike was a fledgling track shop out in Beaverton, Oregon, before they signed Jordan. The Bulls were an irrelevant franchise and had been for practically their entire existence, not having won a title in at least since the 50s, if they had ever won one, before Jordan. The 23 on his uniform was known around the world. His face, his name was correlated with every big thing you could come up with: Coke, Gatorade, Nike, you know, Hanes. And it's funny, Anton Jameson, an old North Carolina alum who still plays pickup ball with Jordan, says he could still play in the NBA at this point. Still average 10, 12 points a game. Guy's 49, 50 years old. And half of him, you know, there's a part, he has not succeeded as an owner or a GM like Larry Bird did. He hasn't stayed in the spotlight like a Magic Johnson has to the same degree. Maybe it's because of the lack of success in Charlotte. Maybe because it's, you know, whatever reason it is. But he is the greatest basketball player I've ever seen. He, you know, along with Magic and Michael, you know, Magic and Michael started the transition of the NBA back into national relevance. They're going to a whole new level. And all NBA fans are grateful for him, well, except for me, because I was a Portland Trailblazer fan and we didn't win a title because of him, in part. But for all intents and purposes, Michael Jordan...
We didn't win it either.
What'd you say?
I'm a Knicks fan. We didn't win it either.
Yeah, but nobody cares about the Knicks. Oh, wait a minute. I'm in New York. I forgot everybody cares about the Knicks. Jordan, he was the first athlete to truly be above and beyond the sport that he played. At least since Muhammad Ali, so of our lifetimes, of the 20, 30, 40-year-olds. And for that, you know, all sports fans should, either you should be eternally grateful or you should roll your eyes in exasperation. But the one thing is, Jordan was the best there ever was. For Sean Palmer, this is Seth Kamen's BackSportsPage.com. Seth and Sean, check it out next week, everybody. Have a good one.